Columnist Barbara Ehrenreich, for example, said the United States was responsible for the vast global inequalities in which terrorism is ultimately rooted. This viewpoint was applauded at a Washington, D.C. town meeting sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus. And on the American campus, several professors went further, blaming the United States itself for the carnage of September 11th. University of Massachusetts professor Jenny Tration suggested that America deserved what it got because throughout the world it was a symbol of terrorism and death and fear and destruction and oppression. These strong words should not have come as a surprise. For years, the left-wing opponents of globalization have carried banners in Seattle and elsewhere saying, America must be stopped, and the world is not for sale. On campuses across the country, professors have been teaching their students what Columbia University scholar Edward Said recently argued, that America is a genocidal power with a history of reducing whole peoples, countries, and even continents to ruin by nothing short of Holocaust. Many intellectuals and activists have devoted a good deal of their adult lives to opposing what one termed a world laid to waste by America's foreign policy, its gunboat diplomacy, its chilling disregard for non-American lives, its barbarous military interventions, its support for despotic and dictatorial regimes, its marauding multinationals, its merciless economic agenda that has munched through the economies of poor countries like a cloud of locusts. Could Bin Laden have put it better? If what these people say is true, then America should be destroyed. The most serious internal critique of America comes from the political movement called multiculturalism. This group is made up of minority activists as well as of sympathetic whites who agree with their agenda. The multiculturalists are a powerful, perhaps even dominant force in American high schools and colleges. The pervasiveness of their influence is attested in the title of a recent book by Nathan Glazer, We Are All Multiculturalists Now. This group has become the shaper of the minds of American students. The multiculturalists are teaching our young people that Western civilization is defined by oppression. They present American history as an uninterrupted series of crimes visited on blacks, American Indians, Hispanics, women, and natives of the Third World. This is the theme of Howard Zinn's widely used textbook, A People's History of the United States. Other leading scholars affirm Zinn's basic themes. Cornel West, who teaches African American studies at Princeton, says that American society is chronically racist, sexist, and homophobic. Political scientist Ali Mazrouhi goes further, charging that the United States has been, and continues to be, a breeding ground for racism, exploitation, and genocide. The reason America exercises such a baleful influence, multiculturalists argue, is that the American founders were slave owners and racists who established what one scholar terms a model totalitarian society. No wonder that multiculturalists are not hopeful about the future of the American experiment. In the words of historian John Hope Franklin, "We are a bigoted people and always have been. We think every other country is trying to copy us now, and if they are, God help the world." Multiculturalists insist that immigrants and minorities should not assimilate to the American mainstream, because to do so is to give up one's identity and to succumb to racism. As the influential scholar Stanley Fish puts it, common values, national unity, assimilation, these are now the code words and phrases for an agenda that need no longer speak in the accents of the Know-Nothing Party of the 19th century or the Ku Klux Klan of the 20th. The multicultural objective is to encourage non-whites in America to cultivate their separate identities and to teach white Americans to accept and even cherish these differences. For multiculturalists, diversity is the basis for American identity. As a popular slogan has it, all we have in common is our diversity. Multiculturalists also seek to fill white Americans with an overpowering sense of guilt and blame so that they accept responsibility for the sufferings of minorities in America and poor people in the rest of the world. One favored multicultural solution, taken up by the Reverend Jesse Jackson upon his return from the recent United Nations-sponsored World Conference on Racism in Durban, is for the American government to pay reparations for slavery to African nations and to African Americans. "The amount we are owed," says black activist Haki Madhubuti, "is in the trillions of dollars." What we have then is a vivid portrait of how terrible America is and of the grave harms that it has inflicted on its people and on the world since the nation's founding. These charges of the low origins of America and its oppressive practices and its depraved culture and its pernicious global influence, are they true? If so, is it possible to love our country? Or are we compelled to watch her buildings knocked down and her people killed and say in unison with her enemies, "Praise be to Allah"? To make us love our country, Edmund Burke wrote, our country ought to be lovely. Burke's point is that we typically love our country for the same reason that we love our children, because they are ours. Some people have kids who are intrinsically unlovable, but they love them anyway. This partiality that we all show for our own seems to be part of our tribal nature. But Burke implies that this is not the highest kind of patriotism. In the movie The Patriot, the hero, played by Mel Gibson, refuses to fight for America until his son is killed and his home is burned to the ground. Despite its great battle scenes, the film conveys the message that patriotism is a kind of selfishness. This would not seem to be the noblest form of patriotism, which calls us to look beyond private interests to the public benefit. As Burke suggests, the genuine patriot loves his country not only because it is his, but also because it is good. Now more than ever, we need this higher kind of patriotism, and it is by necessity a patriotism of the reflective sort. Reflection was not in evidence when, in the aftermath of the terrorist attack, an Arizona resident named Frank Roque fired 3 bullets into a Sikh gas station attendant, killing him. When the police arrived, Roque explained his actions. "I am an American." Actually, so was the man he killed, Guru Khalsa. Roque apparently thought Khalsa was a Muslim from an Arab country. Wrong man, wrong country, wrong religion. This was a rare incident, but even so, it is brutish exhibitions of nativism like this one that convince some thoughtful people, like philosopher Martha Nussbaum, that attachment to any tribe or nationality is dangerous, and that our moral allegiance should be to the community of all human beings. If the only possible patriotism were based upon my country right or wrong, then Nussbaum would be correct. If patriotism were inevitably to degenerate into the kind of blind hatred that motivated Roque, then we are better off without it. But one can make a distinction between nativism, which is based on resentment, and patriotism, which is based on love. The former is objectionable, but the latter is indispensable. Certainly America requires it now, and will require it even more in the foreseeable future. Even when our initial anger toward our enemies has cooled, we still need an enduring attachment to our country to see her through the long trials ahead. America desperately needs the love of her citizens for what she is and for what she might become. A patriotism of this sort, a thoughtful and affirming patriotism, must necessarily be based on an examination of first principles. The need for this approach was illustrated by an American radio show host who recently erupted, "I don't know why those crazy Muslims want to fight with us. They believe in Allah this, Allah that, and they don't realize that we don't give a damn. So why can't we just agree to disagree?" The reason, of course, is that agreeing to disagree is a liberal principle, and it is liberalism itself that is being disputed here. The procedural liberalism that we are so used to invoking, which presupposes that liberal mechanisms like free speech and equal rights are the best way of organizing society, is ineffective against those who do not believe that these are self-evident goods, and who insist that religious truth and virtue have higher claims.